Thanks, everybody, who stuck it out to the end, the last lecture. As I was saying to the earlier crowd, to everybody who left, they don't get to be on the paper. So, sorry. Okay, so for the last lecture, I'm going to tell you about some anomalies in four-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. And this is mostly about the work of Gyoto, Komogodsky, Kapustin, and Seiberg. And there's actually a related paper by myself, Hotat Lam, who's here, Dan Fried, who's here, and Nadi Seiberg, who was here last week. And you know, just to set the stage, we've learned a lot of, you've maybe heard a lot about some kind of abstract formalism, lots of new topological field theories, new notions of symmetry. But for me, the kind of main proof of the pudding of those methods is in the eating. And it's very striking to see that those new ideas can teach you something fundamental about such a basic but deep quantum field theory. Okay, so what is the setting? So the setting is four-dimensional Yang-Mills theory. And for simplicity, we will take the gauge group to be SUN for this discussion. You can run a similar discussion with lots of other different gauge groups and find analogous results. And you can find that in the literature, in particular in this second reference. But we'll focus on one particular example so that everything can become concrete. So how is this theory defined? Well, there is a Euclidean action. Which we write as follows. S, so it has a standard kinetic term. Trace F wedge star F. F is the field strength for a non-abelian SUN connection. And then the hero of our story today will be an additional term, the so-called theta term, which looks like this. So a lot of our discussion will be trying to understand what is going on with this term. So here, G is a coupling constant. I'll put constant in quotes. In fact, this is sort of the microscopic definition of the theory. You should think that that is the starting point at high energies. And as you flow to long distances, G grows. So G runs with scale. So it's not really a constant. And theta is an angle. So we'll discuss that, why it's an angle, in just a second. But so you should think that this is kind of like a one-parameter family of theories labeled by theta, very analogous to the particle on the circle. And many of the properties that we discovered there will carry over to this context. Okay. So we need to understand the so-called instanton number. Let me give it a name, I. What is it? It's given by this Chernyve formula. Okay, and for those of you who know Chernyve theory, you'll know that immediately that this is actually the correct normalization, if this is the trace in the fundamental representation, to define C2, second Chern class. And therefore, this is an integer. We're in four dimensions, so C2 is just a number. So you can now look at the partition function. And physicists believe that this is defined by a functional integral. As was alluded to in Cantaro's talk, if you can really define it this way, rigorously, you might get rich, though $1 million is looking like less and less these days. So, okay, the definition has sort of two pieces. So we're trying to define a partition function. We put here the exponential of minus the Euclidean action. So we've got this positive part. We're integrating here over a space of connections. And then using the instanton number, I can put this phase I theta I. And so this is an integral over the space of connections. And you can view these as the space of connections on a fixed bundle topology. And in addition to this sort of integral over this connected piece, we also have a sum over the different bundle topologies. So the partition function also involves a sum over all possible bundle topologies, which are just labeled by the second turn class, what I called I. So what you see from this formula is that the role of the term theta is to control the term proportional to theta, is to control how different bundle topologies contribute to the sum. So we weight the different bundle topologies a little bit differently. So this setup defines a renormalization group flow. You have at short distances, this is the definition. You could, at least if theta equals zero, one can put this on a lattice even. This is the definition at short distances, and our goal is to try and understand what happens at long distances. And there is some lore, and it's not just lore, there is quite a lot of evidence for this lore. But I'll present it as lore, given that the audience contains some mathematicians who might try to prove this rigorously. So the lore is that at theta equals zero, the infrared is what physicists call trivially gapped. Or equivalently, invertible. So at short distances, this theory has some, looks like it has some gluon particles, but at long distances, they all interact, form bound states that acquire a mass, and at even longer distances, they're lifted from the spectrum, and there's not even any topological degrees of freedom left over. So that is supposed to be the picture of Yang-Mills theory at theta equals zero. And as I stressed, there is a lot of evidence for that. In particular, at theta equals zero, you can put the theory on the lattice. And you can do numerical simulations. So a question to ask is, can the picture be so simple for all values of theta? So can the IR be invertible for all theta. And the answer to this question is a resounding no. In particular, for at least one theta, the IR is non-invertible. And we will discuss at the end of the lecture what people believe that infrared is. Okay, so we'd like to prove, at least at the physicist level of rigor, that for some particular value of theta, the theory can't be invertible. The only real method we have for doing that in a strongly coupled theory is to find an anomaly. So we'd like to, an anomaly is an obstruction to the theory being invertible, and so we'd like to find an anomaly. That's how we're going to proceed. Are there any questions? Okay, so to find an anomaly, we'll need to first spend some time discussing the symmetries. What are the symmetries? So one symmetry is a one-form symmetry, which Kentaro discussed. And since it was presented there, I can go kind of fast. So the center of SUN, this is the group ZN. So we have a one-form symmetry. Same group, but it's one form, so I'll put a superscript on it to remember that it's not an ordinary symmetry, but a one-form symmetry. The charged objects are Wilson lines. And we can use the expectation values of Wilson lines, and in particular the existence of the one-form symmetry, to detect confinement. The charge of an IRUP R is its charge under the center. Right, Wilson lines are labeled by simple Wilson lines are labeled by irreducible representations of the gauge group, and the charge of a given representation is, you can think of it as the number of boxes in a Young tableau. Mod n. So every Wilson line is associated to some Young tableau, and that's how you would read off what the one-form symmetry charge is. Now, when you have a symmetry, you have a kind of background field, something that you can probe the symmetry with. And you've heard many times now that the correct background would be an object A, which we can think of as being in the second cohomology of our space-time manifold X with coefficients in Zn. It's the second cohomology because this is a one-form symmetry. Okay, that's true abstractly, but how do we access this background? How do we turn it on? Well, this was also discussed, but since I need the concrete formula, I'll write it. We'll access it via studying SUN modulo ZN bundles. So here you have an additional characteristic class. Which, perhaps by an abuse of terminology, physicists call also W2. So if you have a SUN mod ZN bundle, there's an additional characteristic class called W2, which is in the same cohomology group. And this is, of course, the obstruction to lifting this PSUN or SUN mod ZN bundle to SUN. Okay, so probably many of you have seen this. But some of you haven't. And for those of you who haven't played around with these kind of characteristic classes, it might feel a little slippery. Let me give you a homework problem related to that. So homework. Let's consider a bundle with structure group U1. Thought of as the Cartan of SO3, which is, of course, SU2 mod Z2. So we're considering an SO3 bundle, but one where the structure is reduced. And then you're supposed to show that W2 equals C1 of this bundle mod 2. C1 means F over 2 pi. In a kind of connection form. And so for this reason, physicists sometimes call these classes the discrete magnetic flux. Because for a U1 bundle, C1 is the magnetic flux. Okay, so in any case, we want to access backgrounds for this one-form symmetry. We're going to do it with this additional characteristic class. What's the formula? So the partition function coupled to A is what? So we write Z of A. A is our background field. And okay, we again have this integral over functional integral over continuous connections. I still write the same e to the minus s, but now I modify the sum a little bit. So I sum over I, and I hold W2 equal to A fixed. So this is the bundles that are being summed over here are in general not SUN bundles, but are rather SUN mod ZN bundles. However, I am not summing over all of them. I am summing only over those SUN mod ZN bundles where W2 is fixed to be this argument A. So you can compare this to if we had set the initial gauge group in our problem to be SUN mod ZN, then W2 would have been summed. So by contrast, this defines an observable in the SUN theory. Questions? Okay, well then let's keep going. So we've talked now about the one form symmetry, but there's another symmetry, kind of a always more subtle symmetry, which is time reversal symmetry. And the basic point here is that the theta term is odd under reflection. I.e., if we change orientation, our space-time manifold, C2 changes sign. Or maybe I should even more formally write, C2 evaluated on X changes sign. For the physicists in the audience, you can see that more transparently by writing F wedge F in terms of the Levi-Civita tensor. And then you'll see, since the Levi-Civita tensor is odd under reflection, that's why you get the sign. So because of that, this is very analogous to the particle in the circle with the same theta term. And because of this fact, we can say that for general theta, T is not a symmetry. But there are two special points. In theta space, where T is a symmetry. These points are theta equals 0 and theta equals pi. Here I am again using the fact that theta is identified with theta plus 2 pi, which was true because the instanton number was an integer. C2 is an integer. So pi and minus pi look naively different, but by shifting theta by a period, you get back to yourself. Maybe just a small comment. You might note, just to, as a point of observation, that if you look at e to the minus s, which, okay, it's not on the board anymore, takes this form. And so at theta equals 0 or pi, e to the minus s is real. In general, the exponentiated Euclidean action is complex, but at theta equals 0 or pi, it is real. And this is expected from reflection positivity. Which is the Euclidean version of unitarity. and T-symmetry. So in general, in a theory without T-symmetry, if you do a reflection, the action should complex conjugate. But if that's actually a symmetry, the action should come back to itself and hence be real. Okay, so these are the two symmetries. We have the one-form symmetry, which we access by coupling to SUN mod ZN bundles with fixed second Seifel-Whitney class. And we have the reflection symmetry, the time reversal symmetry. And we're going to examine the interplay between them. So to do that, we'll have to learn about an interesting topic, which in physics goes under the name fractional instantons. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. And the main point here is that the quantization of I which was defined by this formula, but this is different for SUN and SUN mod ZN. So I already stated for you that for SUN, this is just computing for you the second Chern class, and hence is an integer. But for SUN mod ZN, we'll see that the story is a little more subtle. So one way to get at this is to use the relation between UN and SUN mod ZN. So we understand basically everything about UN bundles. And we're maybe confused a little bit about SUN mod ZN. But we know that as a group, we can think that UN is the same as U1 product with SUN modulo their common ZN center. And therefore, if you want to understand what's going on for SUN mod ZN bundles, you can kind of figure it out by understanding UN bundles and U1 bundles and taking into account this diagonal quotient. So using this, we can find bundles with, they will be bundles of UN with the property that W2, if we think of the kind of individual components here, SUN and U1, W2 of the PSUN bundle would be equal to C1 mod N. So this is C1 of the U1 bundle, which we could think of as trace F over 2 pi. So that's how to build a UN bundle out of the individual constituents there. And now using that, you could evaluate I, and you can just see what you get. So I won't go through all the details, which are in both the papers, I believe, that I referenced. But I'll just tell you kind of the key ingredients, and you can see how to work it out. So now you use that If you have a UN bundle, C2, which we always know is an integer, takes the following form. Okay, there's the piece that we had before, but then there's a piece that's sensitive to just the trace of f. So you need this. So of course this is an integer for a UN bundle. So you use this, and then you can derive that I, so for an SUN mod ZN bundle, the following formula holds. I equals C2 minus N minus 1 over 2N. And what appears here might be rather confusing at first, but we'll try to understand it. It looks like it's W2 cup W2, but here these are really integral lifts. I lifted W2. I assumed that W2 could be lifted to an integral class here. So maybe we'll put tildes to remember that they were the integral lifts. So what is this? Well, this is what is referred to as the Pontryagin square. So let me just say this operation. Okay, the first thing is to remember how to spell Pontryagin. So this is an operation P, typically only defined when the coefficients here are even, but physicists kind of abuse conventions. And write something when n is odd as well, which is just very silly, but we'll write it anyway. So it's an operation that takes a cohomology class in degree 2 to one in degree 4. If n is even, you get something with coefficients in 2n. You double the coefficient range. If n is odd, keep the same coefficient range. This is needed so that I can write a formula in the end that will be valid for both n even and n odd. Okay, so mod n, P of a class, is just the cup square of that class. If lifts exist, P is the cup of the lifts. So if you can lift P, the class, to Z2n coefficients, you just evaluate the cup product there. And finally, another property that is useful to know is that if n is even and x is spin, then P is divisible by 2. And in fact, that follows from this. So, what did we kind of derive here, and derive in quotes, but what did I sketch out for you? What's the formula for I? So, the formula is that, so for SUN mod ZN bundles, you have the following. You have I, which I won't write again because I've written it so many times, 1 over 8 pi squared trace F wedge F. this is equal to an integer, which is the part from C2. And then you have an offset, n minus 1 over 2n, integral over x, p of w2. So this is an integer, and this is in general a fraction. That's why this discussion is about what are called fractional instantons. So configurations with non-integer I are sometimes referred to as fractional instantons. I haven't imposed anything like a self-duality condition here, but one could do that. We won't need anything like that. Okay, so, yes?
What do you mean by implicit?
So, W2 is, in general, a class in the second cohomology with coefficients in Zn. And in general, there is no class in, say, H2 of x with coefficients in Z2n, such that if you reduce it to mod n coefficients, it gives you that W2. But if there is one, then you can compute P using that lift in an easy way by just doing the cup product there. Other questions? Okay, so since it's no questions, it must be very easy, so then I'll give you a homework. So construct an SO3 bundle on T4 with connection such that I is fractional. If you're feeling ambitious, you can try to even make it a real instanton, try to make it self-dual. That's one of the few setups where this could be analytically worked out. You can write down simple analytic connections with that property. Okay, so we've got enough setup to get to the punchline. So let's zoom in at the interesting point, which is theta equals pi. And we're going to proceed as we did in the case where we were studying the particle on the circle. Things are quite analogous, but we're in higher dimensions. The mathematics is a bit more sophisticated, but the kind of essence of the derivation is the same. So step one is we couple to a background for Zn1. And after we do that, we're going to check T invariants. So that's analogous to what we did in the particle in the circle, where we coupled to a background U1 connection, and then we checked, is the resulting theory exactly C invariant on the nose? We're going to do the same thing here, but it's slightly more subtle. Okay, so all the interesting features are happening in the imaginary part of the action. So the imaginary part of the action at theta equals pi is I pi times the instanton number, capital I. And just as in the particle in the circle, there is also a new term that we can write that depends only on the background fields. So let's write it. So there's a level k. And then here we have a Pontryagin square term. So this is a new counter term that's available. When we turn on the background field, we can add this term to the action. Here k is like the level, so k has to be integral, and we can think of it as being in z to n. Well, depends on whether n is even or odd, actually. If n is even, k is valued in z to n. If n is odd, it's valued in zn. Okay, so now we need to evaluate. We've coupled the background fields. Now we've got this this instanton density term weighting the bundles, and we've got this new term. And we need to evaluate how t acts on this. The real part of the action is invariant on the nose, and the imaginary part of the action gets reflected. So t on e to the s, what happens? So you get e to the s, but then a term that you're off by, which is the following, 2 pi I times capital I plus 2k over 2n. Like that. Okay, so an exercise is to derive this. So when the background fields are off, ignore this term. That term just goes to zero. Here you have 2 pi I times capital I. When the background fields are off, capital I is an integer. So e to the 2 pi I is 1, times e to the 2 pi I times an integer is 1. So that's the time reversal invariance of the action in the absence of background fields. Now we're going to use the fractionalization formula to evaluate what happens in the presence of the one-form background field. Which hopefully is still on the board. Yes, it is. So we'll keep that up here. So we have e to the 2 pi I times this quantity. The integer part does not matter. All that matters is the fractional part. So t invariance would now require that 2k is equal to n minus 1. The 2k comes from this term, and the n minus 1 comes from this term. And what you were supposed to observe is that if n is even, there is no solution for k. This is telling you that there is an anomaly between time reversal invariance and the Zn one-form symmetry. Let's make a comment. So note, how bad was this failure? I just erased it. Well, the failure of T invariance is only by background fields. Right, the exponentiated action transforms to itself up to some multiple of the Pontryagin of A. And that means that when A is off, the theory has the symmetry. That's the general property of the anomaly. We've highlighted that many times. And we could try to write an associated (5D) invertible theory. And I learned this, how to write this theory, from Dan, so luckily he's in the audience. So what kind of invertible theory is this? Well, it's defined on manifolds without in general orientation, because we have T symmetry. So we're in an O-type cobordism group. And they are equipped with a background field in degree 2 with coefficients in Zn. And I think if you look at the Z2 subgroup, it's easiest to write things there. I think the action, the invertible theory, looks as follows. So it's supposed to be a five-dimensional object. And I think it looks like Pontryagin of the background cup with what is sometimes called W1 tilde. This is the W1 of the tangent bundle of Y. And this here, I believe, is a integral uplift of W1. And I think it has to have twisted coefficients. So Yang-Mills theory is a boundary state, boundary condition, for this invertible theory. This invertible theory characterizes a mixed anomaly between time reversal symmetry and the one-form symmetry.
Sorry. The 5D manifold should be an orientable manifold without a specified orientation or an unorientable one?
It can be defined on either. No. We have T symmetry. A theory with time reversal is the symmetry you need to try to place a theory on a non-orientable manifold.
Yeah, if I couple to background, it's the same. But, I mean, in order to have T symmetry, it's necessary that manifold is orientable. Then, if I couple to background, I'm not specifying the orientation, right?
The, there's a kind of semantic question buried in what you're saying, but I would say that the kind of right notion of background field for a theory with time reversal symmetry is that you can place your theory on manifolds without orientation. Okay, so this is the kind of punchline derivation, is that we've reached a kind of remarkable conclusion that Yang-Mills theory has an anomaly that was not known until about 5 years ago. And to conclude these lectures, we should talk a little bit about the dynamical implications of this. What do we learn about Yang-Mills theory from the fact that there is this invertible theory? So perhaps I should also say that here I made various, you know, assumptions and was even. The gauge group was SUN, but let me stress again that those are just for ease of this doing one derivation on the board. In general, you can work a similar story out for any gauge group. And you'll find often something interesting. Okay, so the main dynamical implication, the one that you're always supposed to conclude when you have an anomaly, is that it is an obstruction to being trivially gapped. So let's write that. At theta equals pi, SUN Yang-Mills for even n cannot be trivially gapped. So if the clay math problem, the millennium problem, had been about theta equals pi, you would have shown that nobody gets $1 million. Unfortunately, a counterexample to the proof, the statement of the problem where you collect the money seems to not allow the possibility that this initial statement is false. Okay, so we know it can't be trivially gapped, so what can it be? Well, anomalies can't, in general, tell you everything. There are many different theories that have the same anomaly. But we can actually do a bit better and exclude some possibilities. So let's kind of enumerate what we might find. So abstractly, what are the possibilities? So one possibility is that it could be gapless. Maybe Yang-Mills theory at theta equals pi flows to conformal field theory. That sounds exotic. So this is certainly possible, but exotic. At least sounds exotic. However, let me point out that the answer doesn't have to be the same for all n. The answer can be different as a function of n. And in fact, an analogous story, if you look in two dimensions, is about the CPN model at theta equals pi. And there the answer is different depending on n. So CP1 at theta equals pi is gapless, but CPN for n larger than 1 at theta equals pi is gapped. So the answer does not have to be the same as a function of n. Anyway, we put this up here. It's a possibility. We can't exclude it based only on the anomaly. The other possibility, if it's not gapless, it must be gapped. And then we can get into some subcases. And actually, the anomaly can help us with those. So gapped, it's not trivially gapped. It cannot be trivially gapped. So it must be a non-trivial TQFT, non-invertible. And now we can make various subcases according to various possibilities for the symmetry. So let's do that. So a subcase is that maybe it is deconfined. So that would mean, in a physicist terminology, that Zn1 is spontaneously broken. This was explained very nicely in one of the other lectures. If this is true, the IR would probably be something like a discrete gauge theory. This means that when you put the theory on a circle, there will be multiple vacua. That would be one consequence of this. So that's one general possibility we might contemplate. Another possibility is that the T-symmetry is spontaneously broken. And this would mean that there's two local vacua. So the dimension on the Hilbert space on S3 would be basically 2, or greater than or equal to 2. And there should be a domain wall controlled by this spontaneously broken T symmetry relating the degenerate vacua. And the final possibility would be a TQFT with both T and Zn1 not spontaneously broken. So there would be no charged local operators under T. And there would be no operators charged under Zn1. Mathematically, one could contemplate that. And you could ask, are all these possibilities consistent with the anomaly? Now, I've reached the conclusion of my time, so I can't give you another lecture about how you use the anomaly to rule out certain kinds of gap phases. But let me tell you, as a kind of teaser, there is a result. This is due to myself and Omori. 3 is mathematically impossible. What does that mean? It means we have some invertible theory, and we want to know, does it admit a gap boundary? But not just any gap boundary, a gap boundary where we put certain constraints on, say, the kinds of local operators that exist and the kinds of line operators that exist. And we ask, can there be a gap boundary with those additional constraints? And the answer is sometimes no. And in this case, the answer is no. So this paper is in one of the suggested readings. So anomalies can do more than just tell you that a trivially gapped phase doesn't exist. They can tell you about certain constraints on a gap phase. So what's the lore? We're not the first people to think about this problem. And in fact, there is some pretty good evidence. So lore with evidence is that possibility 2 is dynamically realized. So time reversal is spontaneously broken. There are usually believed to be 2 exactly degenerate ground states corresponding to having 2 local operators. And there's an exactly stable domain wall created by this spontaneously broken symmetry defect that relates the 2 ground states. Okay, so I've reached the end of my time, and I hope this kind of makes it clear that all of these new techniques that we have been developing in higher symmetry and topological field theory, they really have some punch to them. We can really learn, we really have a chance to learn something new. So I'll stop here. Does anybody have a cube? Maybe it's up to me to throw the cube. Make me work hard. Ready?
Good throw. I guess I have two questions. One is from what you just wrote on the board. Why couldn't you have both symmetries spontaneously break?
You can. These are not supposed to be exclusive ors.
Oh, okay, I see.
Yeah.
Then the other question I had is from like an abelian theta term, I know that theta, for abelian gauge theory, the theta term theta can be 2π periodic or 4π periodic, depending on if you have a spin manifold or not.
Yeah.
Is there a similar case with non-abelian? And if there is, does the story change if you don't have a spin manifold?
There are subtleties. I kind of alluded to one of them by telling you that the Pontryagin has some evenness property on spin manifolds that it doesn't in general have. That's because the second Stiefel-Whitney class of the tangent bundle is characteristic. So yeah, there are some, there are indeed all those kind of wrinkles in play.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, first of all, why in the second possibility the Hilbert space can be greater than 2 and it's not exactly 2?
Well, you can have more ground states than those that are predicted by the degeneracy of T. Maybe you have N and N, and they're different ones of them are related to.
But I would say that this is a mixture of possibility 2 and 3, namely that you have a TGFT in which T is spontaneously broken.
But the kind of factorized TQFT may not talk to the symmetries in any way. There could just be some extra degeneracy.
Okay.
Anyway, the lore is certainly that there are exactly 2 ground states.
Okay. And I have a third question, or maybe it's the second one. If I put the theory on R4, I cannot turn on backgrounds for the ZN1 for symmetry, right?
That question actually is a bit subtle. I think if the theory is really on R4, then you should talk about kind of relative cohomology relative to the boundary of R4 at infinity. And that's actually what Omori Kentaro used to when he was discussing confinement.
Okay.
There are non-trivial one-form generators, but they're like planes that go off to infinity.
But you cannot see the anomaly in R4, right?
That doesn't mean it has no implications for R4, though.
No, I see, but I find strange that I would have said that possibility 1 is more natural, since in order to see the anomaly you have to go to non-trivial topologies.
Well, but both of them have sharp predictions for the behavior of the theory on R4. Whether there are, at long distances, infinite line operators that are non-trivial, that's possibility 1, or whether at long distances there are local operators that are non-trivial.
Okay. And so, final question, what does it happen for PSUN?
What happens for PSUN?
Yeah.
Well, if you commit to one of the possibilities for SUN, then you can figure out what's going on for PSUN immediately. The local dynamics are the same. So, the PSUN and SUN are related by making the ZN one-form symmetry dynamical, right? We saw that the partition function for SUN with the background one-form symmetry is just a slice of the PSUN bundles, and then summing over the one-form symmetry gives you the PSUN bundles, all PSUN bundles. You can, in each of these cases, if you knew what happened to how the one-form symmetry is realized at long distances, that is how it couples to the possible gapped or gapless phase, then you could then gauge the one-form symmetry and immediately conclude what happens to the PSMN theory.
Sorry. In some cases, we can exclude the gapless phases and say that the theory must be gapless. For example, if you have Toft anomalies with continuous symmetries, I think.
You mean we can exclude a gapped phase?
Yeah.
Yes.
But
yes. Okay. So, indeed, there are invertible theories that have no gap boundary at all. That can certainly happen. And the most familiar examples, as you mentioned, are the kinds of anomalies that one reads about in textbooks usually that are kind of characterized by one-loop diagrams of fermions in models with free fermions. And they occur in even space-time dimensions. And then the anomaly actually implies that current correlation function at separated points is non-zero. And so the theory can never be gapped.
Yeah. But instead, the other possibility seems that you cannot exclude the gapless things anytime. But is it true, or there are some cases in which you can say that the theory is gapped, but then you don't know which is the TUFT?
Well, but this can be included into this. You can have a gapless phase that also has a kind of decoupled topological sector. So as far as I understand, I believe that every anomaly could be realized by a gapless phase. That's usually how they're defined.
Okay. There's also a long question in the chat or comment about by Yuvan Wang about a missing factor of 1/2 in the. Or he's asking if there's a factor of 1/2 missing in the action for the invertible 5D theory, and the reason for this is that the Pontryagin square is a Z4 class and not a Z2, I think.
I'm not sure what I wrote, but that formula, a good reference for the formula is Juven Wang's paper. So if he says I'm off by a factor of 2, he's probably right.
Okay, yeah. He also gave the paper as a reference. Yeah. So.
Question.
Oh, question. So if I add some dynamic matter field to break the ZN1 form symmetry to some subgroup,
yeah.
So what would happen to this anomaly? How does it change?
Well, that can be analyzed. I mean, we wrote an explicit formula for instance, the most kind of concrete down-to-earth version is to look at how the action changes when the presence of the background fields under T symmetry. And if you only allow yourself access to a subset of those fields, for some subsets, that change will trivialize, and for others, it will not. But it's very explicit to check.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think Theo had a question. While preserving what? Preserving the anomaly for sure. Yes, but that doesn't mean the gap wouldn't close. The gap would close. No, a first order transition would be possible. I think so, yeah. All right, well, if there's no more questions, let me thank you all for coming to this great school. Thanks a lot.